Good afternoon, everyone. Please be seated. And the Court of Appeals is in session this afternoon. It's nice to be here. I hope all of you are happy to be here, too. I'm joined today by Judge Jerry Tao to my right and Judge Bonnie Bola to my left. Each side has 15 minutes, and is it Mr. Davis for the appellant in our first case, Malios? Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and then on the side for Bank of America and Realty One, we have Ms. Morgan for B of A. Are you going first? Are the two of you in agreement as to how much time to have split?
We are. Right.
Okay, and Mr. Willenberg?
Yes, sir.
All right. Sometimes there are questions coming from the court, so it could bleed over, so we'll just keep that in mind. Okay, so just to be official here today, we're on first on case number 71412, Malios versus Bank of America and Realty One Group. And Mr. Davis is representing the plaintiff, Mr. Malios, or the appellant, Mr. Malios, here today. So, of course, we've all read the materials, but this is a case that required oral argument as part of the pro bono program, and it's probably a good one for argument anyway. So we are very interested in what you have to say. So go ahead, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I represent Appellant Malios, and I'd like to focus my oral arguments on three points today. The first is I'd like to address respondents' assertion that this Court lacks jurisdiction because the notice of appeal was deficient. It was not, Your Honor. Underneath Foreman and Abdullah, the case has been clearly decided that the appellant has specified where he is going to, what order he is going to appeal, and underneath the final merger, he is allowed to appeal the final judgment, Your Honors, and all interlocutory orders underneath. Second, the district court erred when it struck appellant's second amended complaint and reinstated his pro se first amended complaint for trial. That sanction, reviving a superseded, nullified complaint, is not permitted underneath NRCP 37. And thus, it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to do so. Third, the district court erred when it granted three directed verdicts on several counts when there were substantial evidence that supported appellant's claims.
As for Mr. Davis, you won't have to spend much time on the first argument, the jurisdiction, so you can focus your efforts on the other two.
Yes, Your Honor, I absolutely will. I will then begin with the striking of the second amended complaint. Your Honors, NRCP 37 provides a list of sanctions for a party's failure to attend his deposition. Those sanctions are order the question answered, the court may order certain facts established, the court may order the support of certain claims or defenses, or conversely disallow, it may strike all or parts of the pleadings, or it may dismiss the case. And that is all, Your Honors. NRCP 37 does not permit a district court to reach back in time, pull a complaint that has been superseded, and then force a party, or in this case the district court itself, to file that complaint on the party's behalf as some sort of evidentiary sanction. What the court was free to do is strike parts of the second amended complaint. It was free to order some of the other sanctions that were allowed.
But well, let me ask you this, Mr. Davis. What difference did it make? You know, a complaint, in the life of a case, a complaint's a funny thing. It's really important very early in the case. But as you get deeper into the case, right, it's superseded by, you know, you got your JCCR, your pretrial statement, all the other subsequent documents where you delineate your causes of action. You can add causes of action that were in the complaint so long as they're supported by discovery and they, you know, relate back to at least some factual allegation in the complaint. You know, we have all this case law that says that in the initial complaint, it can't be dismissed under 12b-5 even if all your causes of action are wrongly named, so long as the facts support some cause of action. And then you go through discovery, you add causes of action, maybe you dump some causes of action, you identify them in your subsequent discovery pleadings. So by the time you get to trial, what difference does it make what complaint you have, so long as the causes of action that you identified later are still being tried?
Well, and that's a great point, Your Honor. And if you, the record shows that the district court actually turned around and refused to allow the plaintiff to amend his complaint based upon that evidentiary sanction. And furthermore, Your Honor, drew comparisons between the first amended complaint and the second amended complaint in terms of one of Realty One's, or one of the causes of action asserted against Realty One. Specifically, if I recall correctly, it was the failure to supervise claim. And that's why, Your Honor, that particular sanction is not harmless.
Mr. Davis, is it correct that your client, the appellant, was able to make all the arguments, though, that were contained in the second amended complaint and present all the claims at the time of trial?
Your Honor, while the claims were remain the same, the failure to supervise claim was specifically knocked out because of the deficiencies in the first amended complaint.
Thank you.
And that's why, I'm sorry,
Your Honor. No, thank you.
And that's why, Your Honor, that this error was not harmless. Because the district court fashioned to sanction what is allowed, beyond what is allowed by Rule 37, it abused its discretion. Going to the district court's directed verdicts, Your Honors, the district court's directed verdicts overlooked evidence introduced at trial or interdirected verdicts based upon erroneous legal principles. I'd like to discuss each of the three directed verdicts in turn, beginning with the negligent misrepresentation claim against the Bank of America. The district court found that the fraudulent intent was not present and it was a required element. That's faulty, Your Honor. Under Foster v. Dingwell, there is no required for a fraudulent intent in order to sustain a negligent misrepresentation claim. This is further buttressed, Your Honors, by the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 552, and the comments thereto. Nevada looks to the Restatement of Torts in order for persuasive authority, and I believe it was quoted directly as authority in Halpro v. 8th Judicial District Court. But to look at it from a second perspective, Your Honors, if the respondents are correct, then there is no difference between a fraudulent misrepresentation and a negligent misrepresentation claim. They are the same underneath the respondents' interpretations because both require a fraudulent intent. Your Honors, this reading of the law is not supported by Nevada law. Quite frankly, negligent misrepresentation has a narrower scope of applicability, and that is why it is permitted, so long as the defendant has a pecuniary interest in the information in which he is conveying. And in this case, Your Honors, the bank did. Furthermore, the appellant has introduced sufficient facts at trial in order to allow this claim to go to the jury. Specifically, the evidence introduced at trial provided a prima facie case that various Bank of America employees made numerous misrepresentations that the foreclosures would be suspended or that they would be rescinded, and they were not. Furthermore,
was there anything in the record that supported that testimony other than just the recollection of the witness that that's what was said?
No, Your Honor. There was no documents that I recall off the top of my head. But, Your Honor, verbal testimony is the foundation of American Anglo-American jurisprudence. It's gone back since John Adams defended the British troops at the Boston Massacre.
Well, it's admissible because it's not hearsay statement of a party opponent, so it can be relied upon. Certainly be helpful if there was some corroboration.
Yes, Your Honor. No, I agree. But the Bank of America also made those statements without exercising reasonable care or confidence. They should have known, or they did know, that Fannie Mae would not have agreed to those, or at least they had to run it past Fannie Mae first. And as for whether appellant reasonably relied upon the representation, that's an issue of fact for the jury to decide.
Mr. Davis, what is the business transaction at issue here that is necessary to have to state a negligent misrepresentation claim?
Your Honor, I think it's the foreclosures, and I think it's the sales, therefore. That is the business transaction, and specifically what you have, and that begs the question, Your Honor, is how does the appellant have a duty on that? Well, when the appellant has a property interest in the properties, and he did before the foreclosure sales, and we assert that he does now, he still does, but because he had that property interest in the Bank of America, made those representations about when the foreclosure sales would occur or that they would be postponed or that they would be rescinded. That is the business transaction at issue.
So getting away from the legalese for a second, the difference between a negligent misrepresentation claim and a fraud claim, as you point out, is fraud requires intent, right? I intend to deceive somebody, or at least I knowingly make a statement that I should know or do know to be false. That requirement isn't present in a negligent misrepresentation claim because it's replaced by the fact that you guys are involved in a business relationship. The circumstances would suggest that I have reason to believe that you are telling me the truth and that you investigated what you told me, what you're saying, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in this case, he's already missed his mortgage payment. He's heading to foreclosure. He's trying to negotiate his way out of it. Aren't you actually adversarial at that stage? Why in that case, when your client's already in default, does he have the right to expect that the other guy is going to be honest with him when you're kind of careening toward litigation?
Because, Your Honor, underneath the restatement of second 552, what it says is the duty arises when the defendant, Your Honor, has a pecuniary interest in the transaction. And your point is a good one, Your Honor, in terms of, wait a minute, they're adversarial. But in reality, what Bank of America wanted is they wanted either the mortgage satisfied or they wanted to get the bad debt off their books by selling it, but they didn't care which. So, Your Honor, I wouldn't say necessarily that the appellant and the bank were adversarial at that point. There was testimony introduced at trial that said the appellant and or his daughter had the ability to satisfy the mortgages, and if there was no modification forthcoming, they would have done so. They stood ready, Your Honor. But for the fact of the bank's negligent misrepresentations, then it turned into a situation of where they were foreclosed from doing that. At the end of the day, Your Honor, all the appellant was trying to do was to obtain a loan modification. Did he go so in the right way? No. But that still was his aim. That still was his goal.
Mr. Davis, is it your position that the four properties were available to have loan modifications placed?
To be modified, Your Honor?
Yes. Were they subject to loan modification?
Underneath the HAMP program, Your Honors, no, they were not. However, Bank of America had made some representations that there were other internal Bank of America programs to which the appellant would be available for or would possibly qualify for. And part of the reason why the appellant was relying upon the Bank of America statements is because he had received representations that the bank, there were these other programs that they were still checking out when the properties were sold.
Thank you.
Okay, you're just over 4 minutes, Mr. Davis. Do you want to save that time?
With your permission, Your Honor, I want to very, very quickly run through one other item, and then I will cede the podium. Regarding the misrepresentation claim against Realty One, I think it would be helpful if I more articulately stated appellant's position. The question is whether or not Realty One cloaked Mr. Armani in its garb and its authority and allowed him to run a loan modification business from Realty One's offices. The one thing they can't do, Your Honors, and we state it more clearly in our briefs, is that they cannot turn around and rent out an office. They cannot provide him with cards, allow people to come visit him, and then turn a blind eye and not take a look to see what he's doing. At a minimum, there's a dispute of fact there, Your Honors, and it should have gone to the jury. And with that, Your Honor, I'll reserve the remaining amount of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. Melanie Morgan for Bank of America. I took the sign on jurisdiction, so I'm not going to address that, but I would like to discuss, unless Your Honors have any other issue that you'd like for me to address first, the directed verdict on the negligent misrepresentation claim. As a preliminary matter, that cause of action was included in the second amended complaint that was stricken. The first amended complaint included only a cause of action with respect to misrepresentation for intentional misrepresentation. And in plaintiff's pretrial memo, the cause of action is listed as only misrepresentation. If we read the transcript from where the directed verdict argument, where that lies, plaintiff's counsel talks about five jury instructions. And one of those jury instructions is negligent misrepresentation. One is fraudulent misrepresentation, failure to honor a promise, and some kind of like disclosure type concealment instruction. And plaintiff's counsel says that he is focusing on the concealment, the failure to give information. And then the district court judge talks about the element of intent. There has to be fraudulent intent. And at that point, plaintiff's counsel could have said, well, wait a second, we're arguing about negligent misrepresentation. What do we need to show that information was given carelessly? But counsel didn't say that. And in fact, counsel acquiesces and says, okay. So to the extent that plaintiff was trying to argue a cause of action for negligent misrepresentation at the time of trial, that was waived by the failure to speak up at that time. Even if it wasn't waived, though, we know how the jury would rule. So that makes this a very academic question. And the reason we know is because the jury verdict talks about whether, it talks about causation. Because the only claim that went to the jury was the claim for breach of good faith and fair dealing. And one of the elements of that claim that overlaps with the negligent misrepresentation claim is that the jury must find that Bank of America's conduct was a substantial factor in causing damage to the plaintiff. And the jury verdict form included a question that says, was Bank of America's conduct a substantial factor in causing damages to the plaintiff? And the jury answered no. So even if it went to the jury, we know how this would have shaken out. So it doesn't matter that it didn't go to the jury. And we got to remember, at this point in time, the jury had heard all of the plaintiff's case in chief, so they were fully advised of all of the facts. No facts didn't go to the jury in plaintiff's case in chief.
If the plaintiff's counsel should have corrected the judge, what about the defense counsel when the judge started talking about fraud?
If we should have corrected the
right.
judge...
Why make the motion for the directed verdict and then the judge goes off in a direction where the judge shouldn't have gone? You're claiming waiver on the other side for not objecting to it, but your side initiated it.
Oh, so did Bank of America waive the sanction by assuming that the plaintiff was trying a cause of action for negligent misrepresentation?
I know it's confusing because, as you said, there were three different complaints here, and each of them said something different. But we were earlier looking at this. Was the Second Amendment complaint even being used? Was it really dismissed? Were they, all the actions brought forth? I mean, what? I guess that's more of the introductory question. I mean, were the issues tried that were in the Second Amendment complaint?
The reason we briefed that section of the complaint as though the negligent misrepresentation was tried is because the opening brief briefs that cause of action as though it was tried when they say that the court erred in granting the directed verdict. Plaintiff is the master of his complaint. If anyone knows whether that was one of his causes of action that he was trying, it should be the plaintiff. And I think the fact that he didn't correct the judge and say, hang on, there is no fraudulent intent requirement here for my cause of action for negligent misrepresentation tells me that he was honoring the sanction order, which says you're back to the First Amendment complaint, which had an intentional misrepresentation claim. I wish it was clearer. I really do. But that is what we're left with because the pretrial memo only said misrepresentation.
I mean, that kind of goes to his point, which is it's an odd sanction to strike a complaint and go back to the first complaint. The normal course, as you know, if you can strike a claim, you know, which would make things a lot clearer, but that's not what happened, and I think that's part of his argument, which is what kind of sanction is that when we don't even know what the implications are?
I think the sanction is the functional equivalent of striking claims, which is certainly allowed under Rule 37. And it's worth remembering that at the time that plaintiffs brought the motion for leave to amend to file that Second Amendment complaint, it was very late in the game, and counsel had just been retained. He comes in April when the case had a preferential trial setting for August of that year, and the order allowing counsel to come in and amend that complaint was really a gift because it was late, and the court had discretion not to do that, but they did. And so really by this sanction, they are, which was given because the plaintiff was not cooperating, and we could not get any discovery. We could not take his deposition, and counsel kept coming in and out, and there was this pattern of getting new counsel just when it looked like the court was going to entertain very serious sanctions. All of a sudden, Mr. Malios has new counsel. So with that background, it was late in the game that he was afforded that gift of a second amended complaint anyway. And so after the obstructed discovery conduct, the court simply took away that gift. And what it means is she took away certain claims, which is certainly allowed by the rule. And, I mean, actually, under Skeen versus Valley Bank, you can, you know, the court allows for case terminating sanctions. So this is certainly less egregious than case terminating sanctions. He still got to put his evidence before the jury. He still had claims go all the way to the jury. But I don't see this more as reviving an old complaint or an amended complaint. Really, it's striking claims that he brought in the second amended complaint. And then also EDCR, of course, 7.6 allows for sanctions because the plaintiff didn't attend a calendar call during the same amount of time. So, thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Morgan. Mr. Willenberg.
Thank you. May it please the court. Realty One never belonged in this case for an appeal. This is about Mr. Malios and Bank of America fighting over properties with which Realty One had nothing to do. When asked point blank at trial, is there any reason that you sued Realty One other than the fact that you had meetings there, Mr. Malios said no. So if he'd met Armani at a Denny's or an IHOP, bless you, he'd have sued Denny's or IHOP. There's absolutely no connection to this case. There's no evidence for either of the two claims asserted on appeal. Negligent misrepresentation? Well, where's the misrepresentation? Ever, at all, by Realty One. It never said it performed loan modifications. It never said stop paying your mortgage. It never said, oh, we have this loan modification service right here. Go over there. You know, in cases of ostensible agency, like in the hospital cases, there's a notion that, well, you know, if the hospital refers you to a doctor and then says they're independent contractors, maybe the court will balance that differently. Nothing like that happened in this case. And I'll go one step further and point out that the court below found that Armani himself granted its record to Armani, saying, I don't find any misrepresentations here. So even if there were some made-up theory of agency about this, well, what would Realty One be responsible for? For representations that a court found were not, there were no misrepresentations, and appellant doesn't challenge that ruling on appeal. This idea of, you know, there's a tacit endorsement of loan modification services. Well, a tacit is, I guess, an excuse for saying there's nothing in the record to show that this happened. There's just nothing in the record that can be. We can't have had a tacit endorsement of something that the evidence is undisputed we knew nothing about.
Mr. Davis used the phrase blind eye. So if you know what's going on and you just ignore it, does that somehow provide a legal basis for it, or are you indicating the facts don't even support that conclusion?
Well, the facts do not support the conclusion that we knew it. Armani said, I never told anybody that I was running these services there. Mr. Mario says, I've never talked to anyone else at Realty One about the loan modification services. Only Mr. Armani and Mr. I think Thomas was his assistant. There was never any conversation like that.
Mr. Willenberg, was Mr. Armani's business card out at Realty One in the lobby area?
Your Honor, the evidence is in dispute on that.
I'm sorry.
The evidence is in dispute.
Okay.
I will acknowledge that. I will say that even if there's that business card out there, that's a far cry from saying, go to this guy for a loan modification. And by the way, Mr. Malios didn't rely on that to get to Armani. He found him independently, completely independently, a Realty One in, I believe, a foreign language newspaper. Had nothing to do with our case and with what Realty One did. I pointed out in the, or we pointed out in the respondent's brief, that there wasn't any evidence to support either of these two causes of action. And then the reply brief came back and just doubled down. It's like, well, it's cloaked in the authority, it's tacit modification, it's a lot more of, if we'd met at IHOP, we would have sued IHOP. Besides, I'd say, what duty did Realty One possibly breach? We contractually required Armani to work only on real estate transactions in when he was in that office. That seems to me to be going on your way to fulfilling any duty he could possibly have to somebody else about this. Is Malios really arguing that Realty One had some sort of contractual liability? I'm sorry, had a tort duty to inspect the computers of every agent who is working under their roof? That would be a new tort duty. Don't see any cases cited for anything like that. Instead, I think that they're assuming, which of course you cannot do in the law, they are assuming duty and breach simply from the fact of injury. There was no duty, there was no breach, there was no negligent supervision. The district court got it right, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Willenberg. All right, Mr. Davis, you have a little over 3 minutes.
I'll try to be brief, Your Honor. In regards to the waiver, what ended up happening from what I recall the transcript is that they started with their motion to go ahead and get on directed verdict. Bank of America brought up the fraudulent intent first. The district court ran with it. There's no waiver there. Underneath clear, there's some issue in regards to appellate law about how vigorously one must have to oppose something. But generally the rule is, based upon the American jurisprudence, Your Honor, that in the CJS, is that so long as they put enough of an opposition to inform the court that they're opposing a dismissal of the claim, then that is sufficient. The sufficiency of the legal authority, the factual authority is aside. So there's no waiver there. Second of all, Your Honor, Bank of America is absolutely right. The court could have struck claims. The court could have thrown out the complaint. The court could have done numerous things, but the court didn't do that. The court threw out the Second Amendment complaint and revived the First Amendment complaint, and it caused a lot of confusion because that First Amendment complaint was drafted pro se, Your Honor. And you see that in the transcripts later on. In regards to Realty One Group, just for clarity, it is Realty One's actions or lack thereof that lead up to the negligent misrepresentation claim. He asked, what's the negligent misrepresentation? It's cloaking Armonity in his authority. They come in, he sees a big Realty One Group sign on the door, comes in, massive amount of offices. There's a business card of Mr. Armani's up front, at least that's the testimony, again, that was in sharp dispute. There was a business card that existed with Realty One on the back and Las Vegas Legal Services on the front. There is some dispute whether or not that was up front or not. And it was that sort of thing, Your Honor, to where that was that implicit cloaking and authority that led to, that leads to enough for this negligent misrepresentation claim to survive and go to the jury. And for those reasons, Your Honor, unless this court has any other questions. And I'll briefly conclude. And based upon the foregoing reasons and the reasons stated in our opening brief and our reply, we respectfully request that this court grant the relief stated within our opening brief.